This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, filling in for Terry Gross. Jan Egeland has a way of finding trouble. For more than 30 years, he's flown to scenes of international conflicts and humanitarian crises, meeting with guerrilla leaders, warlords, and dictators, and organizing efforts to alleviate human suffering. Egeland is a Norwegian who's worked in his country's foreign service, in the Red Cross and Red Crescent, and was the United Nations Undersecretary General for Humanitarian Affairs from 2003 to 2006. He's written a memoir of his experiences in Darfur, Lebanon, the Congo, Zimbabwe, and other crisis points called A Billion Lives, an eyewitness report from the front lines of humanity. I spoke to Jan Egeland about some of his peacemaking efforts, including several trips to Colombia, a country torn by factional political violence since the 1940s. In the late 90s, Egeland trekked deep into the Colombian countryside to meet with Manuel Marulanda, leader of the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia, a leftist guerrilla group commonly referred to as the FARC, or FARC. Well, Jan Egeland, welcome to Fresh Air. When you finally met with Manuel Marulanda, I mean, this is a man who, as you said, was fighting in the hills for decades. And I think one gets a certain mentality when one spends a life in armed conflict, always in opposition, never having to govern, and also isolated from outsiders. And I'm wondering kind of what your impressions were of him. Did he understand your role, the UN?
Well, I think he did. He told me, listen, you're the first man from an international organization I have met in my 40 years of struggle. And he turned to my colleague, James LeMoyne, and told him, and you're the first gringo I have met ever. And then my friend said, you mean alive? Yes. And then he said, without smiling, yes, alive. So the man is a warrior. He's a peasant. But he should not be underestimated. The FARC, the United Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia, had at that time in year 2000-2001 had 17,000-18,000 boys and girls, women and men under arms. It was the biggest illegal armed group in the Western Hemisphere, fighting in the biggest war of the Western Hemisphere. It is a situation where it's beyond me, really, that we haven't, as an international community, worked harder with the Colombians to end.
Now, as your efforts to negotiate peace in Colombia proceeded over many weeks and months, you had a number of meetings in these remote jungle or mountainous locations where you drove. Sometimes it appeared at some personal risk. And eventually, at some point, you got some of the guerrilla leaders to accompany some of your folks on a trip to Norway and other places in Europe. I thought this was fascinating. Explain the idea of that trip.
Well, the idea of the trip was to bring the two negotiations teams, the government team and the guerrilla team, to see for themselves in Europe that post-Cold War, as we were there, you know, the left and the right could cooperate, that there were social welfare systems, there were social democracy systems that could give what they said they were struggling for, namely the working class and the landless and so on, that they could actually achieve a lot through democratic means. So indeed, some of these guerrilla leaders, including Raul Reyes, who made big news as he was killed in a Colombian government army raid into Ecuador a couple of days ago only, Raul Reyes led the FARC team with four other FARC commanders. Three of them had never been out of the jungle even before. And just imagine how it would be to come to Oslo, Stockholm, Rome, Paris, sit in the Norwegian parliament where the socialist parliamentarian and the conservative parliamentarian would be sitting, you know, next to each other, and they would say, we disagree on everything except that the only sensible thing in this place is to discuss how we can find a compromise on labor rights, on taxation, on distribution of commonwealth etc.
So you have these two groups of people, people from the mountains who've been fighting all these years, government people, the two sides who've seen each other as bitter enemies for years, maybe decades, and they're traveling to a place where you hope that they will see people who are ideological adversaries work together under a system in which both get something. And they also get to do this together and get to know one another. Describe a little bit of what you saw of their personal interaction. Did you see change, for example, among the guerrilla leaders?
Big personal change. I mean, they didn't only get some trust and confidence in us as facilitators and hosts for this whole Euro tour, as it was called. They also started to relate well to each other. The last night in Oslo, we brought them, this was winter and it was snowing, and we brought them on a horse sled into the woods where we sat and drank and ate in a Norwegian cabin. And later at night, they started to sing to each other as they do in Antioquia, a region of Colombia, where one side starts a phrase and the other one has to sing the response in rhyme. It's very difficult, but it was amazing to see that they could do that. Why? Because some of the guerrilla leaders and some of these government officials and industrialists came from the same part of the country. So naively, I actually thought that this was a breakthrough.
So what happened when they got back to Colombia?
Well, my naive optimism turned out to be totally misplaced, because when they came back, the positive press releases they had jointly issued in Norway and elsewhere had caused great resentment among the comandantes who were in the jungle. They were forced to leave all clothes, etc., that they bought on the trip. Every gift that they were given and so on, it was burnt up because their comrades said that there are probably tracking devices, and they were forced to repent this streak of compromise attitude. And we were back to the old lack of confidence in each other, which in a way you can understand after 30, 40 years where there has been a lot of treason on either side and a lot of people who gave in their arms and tried to integrate were killed by right-wing paramilitary groups. I mean, the whole thing went astray. And today, the war is continuing unabated in Colombia.
You know, you describe how this effort at peace ultimately fell apart in part because there were these right-wing paramilitary groups wreaking havoc and inciting revenge. But another point that you made in the book is that you have discovered in many efforts at achieving compromise and peace that you say peace work is 1% inspiration and 99% hard organizational labor, and that Pastrana, the president of Colombia, although he had a vision for peace and a commitment to it, didn't really develop the organizational capacity to get the hard work done. And I'm wondering, what does that mean in a situation like this?
Remember, in these situations, there you start with zero confidence among the parties, with a lot of bad blood and also a lot of real blood flowing among the parties. It's very hot usually. It's the whole situation when you meet is usually very negative. So people sitting academically working on peace theory do not understand really that it's very hard because there is no rationality in the situation, and therefore you have to work very hard, very long, and you have to be prepared to have 99 out of 100 efforts fail. And still, it's worth the work.
I wanted to talk to you a bit about a fascinating meeting that you had with Robert Mugabe, the leader of Zimbabwe. And Mugabe was one of two rebel leaders in Zimbabwe when it was Rhodesia, when it was a white-ruled country. He was the leader of one of two rebel groups. They were ultimately successful and instituted majority rule, but the country has sort of fallen apart. He's become an oppressive dictator. And you went to talk to him about getting him to accept UN assistance in some emergency housing needs. Briefly, what was your goal there? What was the crisis you were addressing in Zimbabwe when you met with Mugabe?
I went there in December 2005 because Mugabe and his party had undertaken a disastrous eviction campaign of tens of thousands of city dwellers from their houses, some from shacks, some from real houses. These were mostly people supporting the opposition, and the whole excuse was that this was urban renewal. But what they really did was to bulldoze a lot of homes. So I went there to protest this, of course, but also to say we wanted to help the hundreds of thousands now of homeless.
Well, I wanted to talk a little bit about the process because I thought it was a fascinating dynamic. He meets you and he is surrounded by a bunch of his ministers, and it sounds as if initially he's sort of performing for them. I mean, you say tens of thousands of people need temporary tents because they need shelter, and he blusters and evades and says, "There is no, we need permanent housing. We don't need tents." And then at some point you really bore in and you say you tried to establish eye contact. What was going on there?
This is a leader of the, as you said, of the anti-apartheid struggle in what was once Rhodesia. He's one of the eldest statesmen of Africa. He should know that his people were massively suffering. Zimbabwe was the breadbasket of the southern African region. Now they need to have emergency relief from abroad, including from the United States, to feed 2 to 3 million of their people. And what he showed, and I think part of the problem was that, yes, he had his own minister sitting around watching us. He was not willing to realize the real situation. And I did ask, therefore, for a meeting eye to eye with him.
Just to clarify, Jan Eglin, you're saying you asked his ministers to leave. You said, I want to speak with you alone.
Yes. If it's not going well in group, I always ask, can I have a few minutes with you, one-to-one? And sometimes they agree, sometimes they don't. In this case, he agreed. And that turned the meeting into more of a real dialogue, whereas before then, he had said all of these things like, tents are for Arabs. I don't want tents for our people. Build permanent housing, which, of course, I could say we cannot build permanent housing for hundreds of thousands of people from one day to the next. We will not even get money for that. You evicted these people. The donors will give us zero for housing when you evict people like that. So we had a complete clash. When I met him eye to eye, he was willing to listen, and I thought we had actually some understanding of how to try to get out of this vicious cycle that Zimbabwe was locked in.
And what was the result? Were you able to get him to accommodate the UN in providing some temporary shelter for these homeless families?
Yeah, we finally got agreement of giving temporary shelter to a few thousand people, number one. Secondly, that the World Food Programme was able to provide more food more widely. The World Food Programme has an excellent program there. But, of course, the dilemma I had in this situation was that I always made a point out of telling the truth of what I saw to the press when I would leave a place like that. So I end up the meeting by telling Mugabe, I hope you understand that when I go now to South Africa tomorrow, I have to tell what I've seen. And he said, yes, well, if you say what you've seen and not what Britain wants you to say, it's fine. So I went out and I said, it's a meltdown in Zimbabwe. Average life expectancy has gone down from 66 to 35 years. It's the biggest fall in life expectancy in any place in peacetime, probably ever. It's a meltdown. Mugabe was so angry with what he saw that he denounced me at a big party meeting, calling me a hypocrite and a liar, which, of course, was not the best frame for future dialogue between the two of us. However, the UN team was able to implement many of my proposals.
And one of the things that interested me about this meeting and some of the others that you describe in the book was it showed how you had to constantly, when you're coming into situations where you would deal with guerrilla leaders or warlords or dictators, and on the one hand, you want to establish a friendly rapport so that you can be heard and be treated as someone making a good faith effort to improve things. On the other hand, there's the imperative to confront them with the horrible truth of their own brutality at times. And do you ever find that you push too hard and people say, get out of here, I'm not going to talk to you anymore?
Yeah, I pushed very hard. I mean, of course, the meeting with Mugabe was a very tough one. I do not regret, though, speaking truth to these people. I think they very, very seldom hear that kind of truth. In the situation much more like the one I describe in the book of Mugabe sitting always with 10 ministers around him who nod constantly to whatever he would be saying, you would have lots of places where people would say absolutely crazy things and you would see 20 heads nodding all the time. So it's very important that we confront them with the truth. I've done that also in the Middle East, always trying to say exactly what I've seen, what are the facts as such. However, in my work, the biggest dilemma was not this necessarily of not becoming their enemies. It was that I needed to make sure that our people on the ground were not thrown out.
You know, one thing that's clear as we read your book and describe your experiences in Lebanon and Israel and Iraq and developing the Oslo Accords is that you have a habit of saying what you mean and at times creating controversy. One was when you were overseeing, trying to coordinate efforts for relief for the terrible tsunami which struck in the Indian Ocean. And you made a comment about the developed nations being stingy. This earned you a personal rebuke from President Bush and created several news cycles of comment. Looking back, were you a little too candid there or would you have done it just the same way?
Well, I had said the same thing many times before, and I've said the same things many times after. And I'd like to tell you again that I feel, yes, rich countries, they are drowning. I mean, like Europeans and North Americans and all rich Gulf countries, we're drowning in luxury now. We're 2, 3, 4 times richer than we were a generation ago. That we give on average 0.2% of our gross income to the dispossessed and the billion lives that are now just struggling to survive. I think that's really stingy. I mean, I don't know in any of the holy text or scriptures it says keep 99.8% to yourself and be generous with 0.2%. They say a tenth is very often the ideal. What I might not have done, have I lived again, is to say it in that, even though I got the question, which was a general one, I shouldn't have said it at the end of the first tsunami press conference when all eyes of the entire world was watching me, because it was misunderstood by one US journalist as if I was talking about the tsunami relief, which I wasn't, and the U.S. relief, which I wasn't. So that started the whole cycle, which led to thousands of hate mail and 100 right-wing radio hosts, being after my scalp. And I didn't need that as I was coordinating relief for millions of tsunami victims.
You know, you got the job of Undersecretary General for Human Affairs just as there was this terrible bombing in Iraq which hit the UN mission and killed Special Envoy Sergio Vieira de Mello. And there was a debate then about whether the United Nations should even remain in Iraq. I mean, given that it really had no clear and formal role. I mean, the United States was in effect an occupying power with the coalition provisional authority. Do you think there's a constructed role for the United Nations in Iraq today? You know, a lot of people believe the troop surge has made a difference. Things are more peaceful. Can the UN play a positive role now?
Well, indeed, security has improved of late. There are fewer massacres and fewer terrorist attacks. However, if we are to succeed in Iraq long term, I do, yes, think that the United Nations, the regional organizations, and the neighbors of Iraq has to become more involved longer term. And yes, I think the United Nations is the organization in the world to most successfully do nation building, democracy building, and also regional security together with regional organizations. That's the whole experience of Africa, where there is 50% more peace and less war now than there was 20 years ago. So indeed, longer term, I think, yes, the UN will get a more important role and should have a more important role.
Well, Jan Egeland, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you for having me.
Jan Egeland served as the United Nations Undersecretary General for Humanitarian Affairs. His new book is A Billion Lives, an eyewitness report from the front lines of humanity. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, filling in for Terry Gross. Since playing an introspective sheriff in the 1996 film Lone Star, actor Chris Cooper has gradually become more familiar to movie audiences. Winning an Oscar in 2003 for playing an eccentric orchid thief in Adaptation and delivering a riveting performance as FBI agent Robert Hansen in Breach. Mary McNamara of the LA Times wrote, "Cooper has long been an actor's actor. A slight man, he can project heft when he needs to, and his lined and watchful face, eyes tending toward a squint, can seem naturally menacing or noble, lost or kind." Cooper was a late bloomer in film. He spent years in theater and didn't make his first movie until he was 37. Although he's made over 40 films since then, he's never become immersed in Hollywood culture. He and his wife of 25 years, actress Marianne Leone, still live in Kingston, Massachusetts. Cooper's starring in a new film with Patricia Clarkson, Pierce Brosnan, and Rachel McAdams called Married Life. Cooper plays a middle-aged married man who's in love with a younger woman. Here he is with his wife, played by Patricia Clarkson, at bedtime in their suburban home.
You know, the other week at the cabin, John O'Brien was telling Newt Baum that he thinks a woman who does a lot for a man can pay a heavy price.
What do you suppose he meant?
Oh, it's all rather uncomplicated, I'm sure. He was drinking, you know, John.
What is the price a good wife pays? Tell me.
I don't know. Just skip it. You'll upset your stomach.
No, go on.
I'd say he was probably thinking that if a married man falls in love with another woman, the dedicated wife is surprised and hurt. And she remembers him as he was before they married, and she sees him now as she made him, a better finished product altogether. A product another woman is soon going to enjoy.
Well, Chris Cooper, welcome back to Fresh Air. In this new film, Married Life, describe the character that you play, Harry Allen.
Harry Allen's, I guess we'd say he's upper middle class, very successful man, and a home builder. This is, takes place in 1949, so he's made his money from the house building boom. And but he's reached a point in his marriage where I think it's gone a little bit flat. His wife, played by Patricia Clarkson, is, I think, sort of has modern attitudes about love. Harry Allen, having lost his parents very early in his life and being pushed off to an aunt, and that aunt moved him to a boarding house, he never felt he had affection in his life, and he was a bit of a romantic. And though this marriage was, as Pat, his wife, says, it's based on sex, he's looking for more. And he pursues that.
You know, part of this story is about people whose love has grown old and familiar and that they've come to take one another for granted. But it's also about the power of new love. This is a middle-aged man who is crazy in love with a younger woman. And I wonder, is a middle-aged man in this kind of infatuation any different than a lovesick teenager or college kid? Do you play him any different?
I think that's pretty good comparison. I was interested in developing the naivete of this man and the narcissism. And this is something that the audience won't see, but for my own comfort as an actor and developing a background, I went on a little sentimental journey, took a look at my mother and father's relationship, a man who was very dedicated to his job to the point that he was a bit naive about the outside world. My mother, I think, was very very strong in the same respects that the character of Pat is. And so I would agree with you that Harry, always believing he never had someone to be romantically involved with or somebody who gave him affection, he went to this younger woman in pursuit of that.
I'm just, how did you do this reconstruction or reminiscence about your parents' and grandparents' relationships? What was the raw material?
The raw material is simply, you know, sitting back and using my imagination and some observation that I just told you about my mother and father were imaginings that I tried to apply to Harry. As I said, my father was very, very dedicated to his work, and not that it happened, but that he was so trustworthy of my mother. She very easily could have had an affair, and my father would have probably never even dared suspect.
Yeah, I mean, clearly one of the themes of this film is how little we sometimes know about the person, you know, sharing our lives and our beds. And I'm wondering, do you feel that way about your own marriage? Do you feel like you have a pretty good idea of what's going on with your wife?
Oh, I certainly hope I do.
Yeah,
I'm sure there are some mysteries. I mean, I can, if I string all the months that I was gone from home in 06, working on three films, I was away from home for 7 months. But then on the other hand, when I'm home, I'm there 24/7. Marianne and I are literally in each other's face throughout the day. But it's always interesting. She's a writer, actor, and we make a great team. I depend on her take on anything that I'm working on. And in fact, in many instances, scripts and jobs that I've been hesitant to take, she has, you know, pressed me to think about it. If I so fear it, all the more reason to take that job. And they have turned out to be some of the most rewarding pieces of film work I've done.
Huh. Can you think of an example of that, something that you wouldn't have taken but for her advice?
Oh, sure, yeah. I did a film called American Beauty with Kevin Spacey and Annette Bening. And as I kept reading that script, I got into more and more of a deep funk about it. I thought it got to be so negative.
Yeah, well, and let's remind the audience about your role. I believe you played a sort of a repressed homosexual guy, a former Marine living a suburban life, right?
Yeah, Colonel Fitz was newly retired. I created the idea that here was a man who and his family who lived on a base all their life, and here they were moving into a new neighborhood. He's newly retired, away from everything that he knows, and this is a lost man coming to this neighborhood.
And reading it, you didn't want to do the role, and your wife said, go for it?
Yeah, I was a little frightened of the character and where I had to go in creating and portraying the character. There was a lot of newness, stuff I was unfamiliar with, places I had to go with my sexuality as an actor and as a person that was a little freaky. She suggested when you're that fearful, that's a point of challenge, and you should go after it. And I will be forever grateful that she helped me make that decision.
Yeah, well, it was a memorable performance, and you got a lot of great attention for it. You know, I'm wondering, what was the risk, do you think, in going those places with your own sexuality and personality? What do you think you feared?
When I receive a script, I like to have it as long a period as I can, because I will be working on it every day or every evening when the house is quiet. And it's along the lines of the Robert Hansen character in Breach. I didn't know if I wanted to, for 3 and 4 months, deal with this character and go to those places, those dark places that that character had to go. In the development of the American Beauty character, Colonel Fitz, this was a man who I thought sort of loathed himself, who and what he was. So I didn't know if I wanted to deal with that for months and months. And the same was the case with the Robert Hansen character in Breach.
Well, Chris Cooper, you got a lot of critical acclaim for the film Breach, which you starred in last year, directed by Billy Ray, in which you played Robert Hansen, the FBI agent who for 20 years sold secrets to the Soviets, was finally arrested. And it's about the relationship between Hansen and a younger agent sent to kind of track his movements and get him, in effect, with the goods. You know, the cliche question for an actor is, what's my motivation? And the fascinating thing about the real character, Robert Hansen, is that, you know, he went to prison, still is in prison, but yes, never really explained why he did it, why he sold these secrets to the Soviets for 20 years. And it's not explained particularly in the film. But I wonder, as an actor, did you feel you needed to understand why he did this?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, in the film, after his capture, we toy with three possibilities of why he may have committed it. And as you said, he's never come forth to say, but I certainly had to justify it for myself and give myself reason for the character.
And so in your head, what was he up to?
I think it was a combination of indeed being a very bright man and being a rabid anti-communist. I think he believed that. I believed in his devout religion. I thought he was a devout man in his religion. And he went to great lengths to show the FBI how vulnerable they were to anybody with some pretty good technology to breach the firewall. And I think he just was not listened to. Add to that, he had a rather unfortunate relationship with his father. His father was always very belittling and sort of wanted to keep Robert under his thumb, never let him be too cocky. I think he had some real problems to deal with, and so I sort of insert all of that into reasons why he did what he did.
You know, the heart of the film really is the relationship between your character, Robert Hansen, and this younger agent, Eric O'Neill, who was sent to watch him, and he's played by Ryan Phillippe. And I thought we'd hear a clip from the film in which this is early in the film and you are sort of establishing your relationship, and this begins with a conversation about getting new computers for the office. Let's listen.
There are pallets of new computers in every corridor of this building. Why don't you go get one?
Okay. I'll just fill out a rec
form. You're not listening. Just go get one. These rec forms are for bureaucrats. Actually, get two. That dinosaur on my desk is useless to me.
Agent Hansen, my name is Eric.
No, your name is Clerk. My name is Sir, our boss, if you can manage.
Yes, sir.
And if I ever catch you in my office again, you're going to be pissing purple for a week.
And that's our guest, Chris Cooper, in the film Breach. Boy, tough relationship there.
Well, you know, a lot of colleagues will tell you that they were very irritated with this man. He did believe himself to be smarter than most of the people at the FBI.
You mean Hansen's colleague at the FBI,
colleagues at the FBI.
The other interesting challenge, it seemed to me, in crafting this character is that Hansen was a guy that people didn't know much. I mean, he was passed over at the FBI. Some people called him the mortician, a guy utterly without charisma. And I'm wondering, how did you craft this guy who could be so seemingly dull and yet be interesting enough to carry a film?
Well, we were lucky enough to have Eric O'Neill with us for about a week before we started shooting.
He was the real FBI agent who worked with Hansen. Right.
Yes, and we peppered Eric, Ryan and I peppered him with all sorts of questions for the week we had him available. There was no audio that I could go by, and what I was provided with about 30 seconds of video tape at the time of Robert Hansen's capture. Now, the man is 6'4", and it got to the point where I asked Eric to give me his best impersonation of the guy. And indeed, his delivery, his pace was very, very lethargic. And he did have this attitude as if he was talking down to everybody he came in contact with. Well, I presented that the first day of shooting, and Billy Ray said, you know, you got to move along. If you continue at this pace, we're going to have a four-hour film. So some things had to go out the door. I wasn't 6'4". I had to pick up the pace of the character. But on the other hand, I mean, I got the word from Eric O'Neill. He was very satisfied with aspects of the character.
Our guest is Chris Cooper. His new film is Married Life. You know, one of the things that occurred to me as I saw your new film is that you play a middle-aged guy who has a regular job, and you're not a sheriff or a cop or a military commander. You've done so many great roles where you're doing that kind of thing. Was that part of the appeal? I mean, is Hollywood come to see you a little bit as the guy who's always the sheriff?
Yeah, and I've begun to kind of speak a little bit publicly that I hope to put a moratorium on CIA, FBI, and military men. I think I played a handful of them. If something comes along that's real interesting, I'll probably come aboard again. But and I think it has to do with your age range and what kind of characters are available out there. I just, to answer your question, I find it kind of interesting that for the film, and I'm speaking about adaptation, the character of John LaRoche, for which I received probably the most notoriety, characters like that haven't come my way, and that was a real stretch as far as comparing most characters that I've played.
In the service of showing Hollywood a little bit of what you can do, I wanted to play a cut from a not as well known film, Silver City, which was a John Sayles film. You've done a lot of work with him.
Yeah.
And in this one, you play a politician who is, and this might sound familiar to some people, he's the son of another well known politician, but this guy you play, whose name is Dickie Pillager, is kind of never-do-well, has had a little bit of a problem with drinking. He's an underachiever. And he's running for the governor of Colorado, kind of really on the momentum of his family name. And here's a cut where he is maybe a little underprepared for a give-and-take with reporters who catch him on the way into the Capitol. Let's listen to this.
Let it rip.
With the amount of federal money coming into the state decreasing
fast, I'm not raising taxes.
But what about the shortfall in social programs?
I repeat, I'm not raising taxes. We can't just keep throwing the taxpayers' hard-earned money at these perceived, and some of them, I admit, are real so-called social problems. Have to get our priorities straight. I mean, education is a priority. Health care is a priority. Our economy is a priority. The whole environmental arena That's a priority, big priority. Building new roads and maintaining the present, keeping the infrastructure in place where it belongs. That's a priority.
What isn't a priority, sir?
What's not a priority?
Yeah.
Is those matters which are of less of a... Not that they're not important, but if you're going to have a front burner, which is where you want your priority.
And that is our guest, Chris Cooper, playing the politician Dickie Pillager in the film Silver City. Well, let's talk a little bit about it. This obviously kind of reminds us of President Bush at some of his less flattering moments. Did you look at the tape of the president? How did you guys put this thing together?
Oh, gosh. You know, since... Really, the day of 9/11, I became such a news junkie. I just watched too much news, and Bush's delivery and all were very, very familiar. I just thank goodness that originally John wanted me to play the Kris Kristofferson character, and at the last minute he asked me to play Dickie Pillager. And it was just great. It was just great fun playing that character.
Do you want to do more comedy?
Oh, I would love to. I would love to. Something, I'm, you know, not of a 16, 17-year-old mentality, but some adult light comedy would just be terrific. I thought, you know, Pierce Brosnan in this film, there's about a 6 or 7 minute stretch in a scene where he discovers something about my wife, and he brings the lightest touch and a light comedy to it that's just delightful, and I'd love to try something like that.
You know, you were on Fresh Air a few years ago, and you told Terry Gross then that you had just worked with Maggie Smith, the actress, for the first time, and you'd said you'd felt a little intimidated by it and had watched some films of her to kind of get acclimated. And you mentioned that you'd kind of felt intimidated, you know, acting with De Niro and some other, you know, great actors for the first time.
Sure.
Are those days behind you now?
No, not at all. Not at all. I mean, and you know, I was working with Meryl Streep and in adaptation, and terribly initially intimidated with the idea of working with her. But she is such a great girl, such a great person. You know, there was one day where we were working on a scene. It's not in the film, but things weren't going right as far as I was concerned. And we were into our third and fourth take, and we were going back to our mark. And I was mumbling to myself and berating myself for things not coming together, and I heard this little voice behind me, and it said, "Stop whining." And that was Meryl, and I really took that to heart. And I think since working with her, I've tried to enjoy the whole process of working in film. I had a tendency to take it a little too seriously, but I'm enjoying it more and more now. But I'm as intimidated working with folks now as I ever was, and I hope it always continues. I don't ever want to to think that I can just rest on my laurels.
You know, I wanted to ask you about something I read, and sometimes these stories aren't quite what they're advertised as. But I read that long ago you wanted to be a lounge lizard. Is that true?
Well, initially I wanted to be a singer, yeah, and I tried to sing at every opportunity I could. I sang at the church choir. I sang in my high school choir, and in that choir there was a male octet, and I sang on a band. We did you know, college dances and fraternity parties, and I was crazy about Johnny Mathis and Tony Bennett, and my parents had taken me to Las Vegas when I was, I think, 14 years old, and I just fell in love with that real, you know, seemingly adult atmosphere. And was a pretty good singer, and matter of fact, I'm looking for a singing role in a film, perhaps, you know, a country western singer or something like that. But yeah, I was real serious about it for a while.
I guess what's interesting about it is that you know, you sort of describe yourself as someone who sees all of the acting roles as a challenge. You never take anything for granted. You're always a little afraid you're not going to quite measure up. And you know, the nightclub singer is the most confident guy we know. He's there, like he's, you know, he's holding that mic and the band is behind him and he owns the world.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I could kind of relate to it. I remember when I used to do some of these, it was in the late 60s when I was in this band. There were places where teenagers could go to dance. The place in Kansas City was called Coy's Castle, and it was a place where, you know, people from all over the county could come together, and different high schools would dance there. And it was a really good kind of powerful feeling. And, you know, I think back on it now, and perhaps the singing wasn't as intimidating as the acting. Now that I think about it, it was a real joy. It was a real joy performing.
All right. We'll get back out in front of a nightclub audience sometime. We'll look forward to seeing you.
Someday.
Well, Chris Cooper, thanks so much for speaking with us.
All right, sir. Thank you. Enjoyed it.
Actor Chris Cooper, his new film, Married Life, opens Friday.